Sanctuary City Showdown today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Trump wants to cut off federal funding for sanctuary cities, but officials in several large U.S. cities, including Minneapolis, are standing firm. They will not ask about immigration status.
Our city would be less safe if we expected our police officers to enforce federal immigration law.
Also, the new smartphone game that links a person's ability to navigate with their risk for dementia.
Someone who has problems with finding their way around, they won't be able to get to those checkpoints as efficiently as someone who's healthy.
Plus, the NFL heads to Mexico City, but a lot of fans there won't be in the stands.
Tickets sold out like in 2 hours, so no, I couldn't get tickets.
The story is today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Good to have you here. Leaders on Capitol Hill are preparing to welcome the new faces that will be part of the Donald Trump administration. But when it comes to the local level, Trump and the mayors of some of the largest U.S. cities are already on a collision course. New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and others have all reaffirmed their role as sanctuary cities. These are places where officials do not ask about a person's immigration status. That runs counter to the platform President-elect Trump ran on to forbid sanctuary cities. He's also pledged to withhold federal funding from any that don't cooperate with him. A lot of U.S. mayors are wondering what's next.
I don't want to overpromise what we as a city can do in the face of federal law and federal law enforcement.
That's Betsy Hodges, the mayor of Minneapolis. Her city passed an ordinance in 2003 restricting enforcement of immigration laws by police and other city employees. Leaders of other cities have gone even further. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio has suggested he would destroy a database listing undocumented immigrants rather than hand it over to the Trump administration. Mayor Betsy Hodges of Minneapolis wouldn't say whether she'd go that far.
Donald Trump really is playing scapegoat politics at the cost of public safety. Asking my police officers to enforce federal immigration law means that were they to do it, victims of crime, witnesses of crime would be afraid to call the police and our city would be less safe.
The largest police union in the U.S., the Fraternal Order of Police, has endorsed Donald Trump. I suspect that organization would not endorse the sanctuary city effort, though. Do you have the support of police officers in your city?
Certainly, the Major City Chiefs Association has a 9-point position about this and includes the concern that it would erode public safety if people don't feel safe calling the police. Also, adequate resources, training, it's not their job, all of that. But at the heart of it, our city would be less safe if we expected our police officers to enforce federal immigration law.
What about the public? Are you worried about them being on board? Because, I mean, there have been criminal sentences for 3 men who joined al-Shabaab this week. Are you ready to push back on public opinion that will refer to this week and will say, hey, really? Is this a sanctuary city? We need this?
The response from the people of Minneapolis has been overwhelmingly positive. People understand that not only is public safety at stake, but larger principles about our democracy are at stake, and that there may be, you know, federal dollars at stake, and that is a problem, and a problem that we will need to solve. But it's a bigger problem if we start eroding the foundations of our democracy, our founding principles as a country.
What federal funding is at risk if you continue to offer sanctuary?
President-elect Trump has not been clear about exactly what it means, federal funding. Is it funding that goes to partners? Is it funding that goes to the city? He hasn't been clear about the scope of it.
If Donald Trump just closed the tap completely, what would you lose?
Clearly, it would be in the millions of dollars and potentially the tens of millions of dollars.
Mayor Hodges, there's been a lot of discussion of what stepped-up deportations might mean, actually, in a Trump administration. Less attention to the deportations that are going on right now with President Obama in the White House. So Minneapolis, it's a sanctuary city, but deportations are still going on right now, yeah?
Well, that's why the term sanctuary city is problematic, and I don't use it. But what I can say is that we will enforce our own ordinances and we will enforce our own policies here and make sure that we are not participating in trying to identify people's immigration status.
So what positive signs are you looking for to suggest that maybe the Trump White House and the big city mayors will not be on a collision course?
You know, my hand is always extended, and I guess I would look for an acknowledgement that this is a significant public safety issue. And if witnesses of crime and victims of crime don't feel safe calling the police, then we are not safe as a city. But the flip side is when Maya Angelou said, when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. That's something I take to heart.
Betsy Hodges is the mayor of Minneapolis. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much for your attention to the issue.
If there's one word that seems to sum up post-election America, it's divided. Here at The World, we, like many across the country and the globe, are trying to better understand these divisions, and so we're regularly checking in with voters on both sides of the political divide. We sent reporter Reynaldo Leaños Jr. to talk to one young man in McAllen, Texas.
Hey, how's it going?
Welcome.
Angel Gallegos is 20 years old and studies finance here in the Rio Grande Valley. He lives about 30 miles from the border. It's also a heavily Latino area where Hillary Clinton won a lot of votes. But Gallegos, he backed Trump. For him, it was about the economy.
We wanted a game changer, someone that could bring jobs to the middle class. Well, Trump came with that narrative and brought American pride, and he also promised a lot of hope for the economy.
Gallegos himself isn't hurting economically. He lives at home with his mom, younger brother, and a cousin. He has no kids, no debt. But there is plenty of poverty around him. Gallegos worries things could get worse. So when he put Trump signs on his lawn, he got mixed reactions, including from his family, mostly Clinton supporters.
A lot of my family members, they weren't really supportive when I first came out. We have a couple of barbecues, and they try to kind of switch my ideological, political views, and for them, immigration was more the reason why they were supporting Hillary more than anything.
He says his mom and his uncles got legal status in the U.S. thanks to Ronald Reagan's amnesty program in the 80s. But Gallegos thinks that immigration policy isn't everything.
For me, I think it's more than that. For me, foreign policy, economy, and other factors are more important.
When it does come to immigration, Gallegos says it's not easy to talk about.
It's very difficult to speak with someone you know, someone that you have a friendship with, and you know they're good people, and that they just didn't come the right way. And it's a very hard topic to speak because it's so controversial, and then you have feelings involved.
Gallegos also says that he rejects the idea that just because he has Mexican roots, he should vote a certain way.
I don't think that being of a certain ethnicity should decide who you are going to support.
He says that makes it hard for him to open up about his views.
Maybe they grow a thought that you're anti-Hispanic or anti-Mexican.
Gallegos says his politics have been shaped since he was a kid.
I was very young when I started seeing that how many taxes my mom was paying, how much was taken off her paycheck that might as well be used to improve our well-being instead of being handed off to politicians who just get to play around with that extra income that could help my family. That was when I became conservative.
His mom says she's proud of her son, but her brothers, they were surprised.
Mis hermanos, pues, sí se molestaban porque decían, ¿cómo voy a creer?
She said they couldn't believe Gallegos put Trump signs on his lawn, but his mom says that's his right.
Le tengo mucha fe a mi hijo que ojalá llegues a ser el mayor de McAllen.
She says she has faith in her son. Maybe he'll become the mayor of McAllen one day. Gallegos does see himself getting more involved in politics, but for now, he says, he'll stay in school and get his degree. For The World, Reynaldo Leaños Jr., McAllen, Texas.
As you just heard, politics is dividing families, and it's dividing them at a time of year that's meant to bring families together. Thanksgiving is a week away, and we're curious, are you going to be sharing a meal with family members who maybe don't see eye to eye with you politically, and is that a source of dread and anxiety? We want to hear how your family is handling the situation. Rupa Shenoy of our Otherhood podcast is here with me to tell us how you can share your story with us. Hey, Rupa.
Hi, Marco. we're asking people to tell us if their family is doing anything different because of this election tension, maybe even canceling Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah, I've heard about that, actually.
Yeah. And then on an individual level, we want to know what you're planning to do. How are you going to engage family members who voted differently? How?
So, Rupa, tell our listeners how they can tell us these things. What should they do?
We'd like them to call what I call the Otherhood Hotline. It's 802-520-H-POD or 802-526-4763. Unfortunately, not a very memorable number. We are public radio, but it'll be on our Facebook page and we'll tweet it out too.
Let me repeat that number, 802-526-4763. So call the number and leave a voicemail, right?
Identify yourself, say where you're calling from, and then, yeah, leave whatever message you like. Keep in mind, you have about 3 minutes.
And then we're going to air some of those messages on the show on Thanksgiving.
And they'll also be in the next episode of the Otherhood Podcast.
Oh, that's cool. So we're going to be reminding you about leaving those messages over the next few days. Rupa, thanks very much for coming in and giving us these details.
Sure thing.
Well, maybe football can bring us all together. The NFL is part of the Thanksgiving holiday ritual, after all, for many people, even if it means suffering through a Detroit Lions game. But TV ratings for the NFL are down this year, and it has the league looking for new fans outside U.S. borders. That's why they'll be playing the next Monday night football game at Azteca Stadium in Mexico City. Residents there are super excited, partly because this is only the second time a regular season game has been played in the nearly 90,000-seat stadium. One of those fans is Sergio Silva Castañeda. I had to ask him, did he score any tickets to the game?
Tickets sold out like in 2 hours.
Wow.
It was kind of crazy. So no, I couldn't get tickets.
So no tickets, but I suspect you're planning to watch this game. What I want to know is, why are people in Mexico City so excited about football?
I watch football every Monday night. So, I mean, the only difference is that now I will be closer to the stadium, actually. But, I mean, it doesn't change my routine for Monday night.
Well, that's you. What about everybody else in Mexico City?
Well, I mean, football is very popular in Mexico, particularly in Mexico City. Like in the Mexican biggest cities, football has been popular for a long time. I mean, since the 1920s, 1930s.
Really? That far back?
Yeah. We have a college league that it's very important. We don't have, obviously, a professional league. And yeah, I mean, soccer is more popular than football. But I would say that football is a close second. When I was living in Boston, I was thinking about this. My good friends who were coming from South America, well, they didn't understand the game, and I didn't have that problem. I grew up watching football in Mexico, so that's not it's not anything exotic for us.
Mm. And people watch like you do on Monday nights?
Usually, yeah. Usually we follow the league. I mean, the Steelers, the Cowboys are very popular teams in Mexico. I think that has to do with the fact that they started showing the games in the 1970s. So, I mean, people got loyal to the best team from those years. And they're still, I guess, the most popular teams in Mexico.
Mm. This is only the second time the NFL teams have played a regular season game in Mexico. The ratings are pretty bad this year. Do you think this is a way for the NFL to expand?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big market. I mean, we're still a big country. We have more than 100 million people around the country, and many of them are interested in football. Now, something that it's important to take into account is that for the average income level in Mexico, this is a very expensive sport. But everyone follows the whole season. I mean, there are teams that people is loyal to certain teams. My dad is a big Cowboys fan, and that includes a bigger chunk of the population, not only the richest part.
So the game between the Houston Texans and the Oakland Raiders, who are you rooting for? What are you really excited to see?
Well, I'm a Patriots fan, so
it's a tough one. It's a dilemma for you.
I don't have big stakes in this game. I hope it's a good game. That's everything I want.
All right. We wish for you a great game down there. Sergio Silva Castañeda, a big NFL football fan down in Mexico City. Big football fan, full stop. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, a high-tech test for dementia. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Our next story is about survival. When ISIS swept into northern Iraq in 2014, some of the worst atrocities the group committed were against the minority Yazidi people. Thousands of Yazidis were killed or abducted. Now Iraqi forces are trying to get the northern city of Mosul out of ISIS control. And there's hope, but also fear, for the hundreds of Yazidi women who are believed to be held captive there. Rebecca Gollard has a story of one young woman now at a center for survivors in the city of Dohuk.
Early one morning last November, Nuhad put on a solid black niqab, only her eyes showing, and snuck out of the house in Mosul, where she'd been held captive for more than a year. The ISIS man that held me went to Syria for 2 days, says Nuhad. I knew it was my chance to escape. She had been lucky. A neighbor who was not with ISIS had given her a phone. She called her father and told him where she was. The neighborhood, the name of the pharmacy on the corner. He raised the $7,000 needed to pay a smuggler to rescue her. I was so happy to come home, says Nuhad, but sad to find most of my family wasn't here. My brothers and sisters are missing. When ISIS stormed Mount Sinjar in August of 2014, they kidnapped thousands of Yazidis, half of them women and children. Nuhad was just 16 years old. Like hundreds of other women and girls, she was eventually brought to Mosul, the largest city under ISIS control, where she was raped, beaten, and sold. Still, for Nuhad, the decision to leave wasn't that easy. She tears up when she talks about the most difficult part. She had to leave her 4-month-old son behind. His father was the ISIS commander who owned her. I can't forget him, she says. Even if his father is ISIS, he is from me. Since her escape, Nuhad has been coming here to the Women and Girls Support Center in Dohuk. The center has helped more than 800 women and girls since opening 2 years ago. Some arrive here sick, sometimes with sexually transmitted infections. Others arrive pregnant, carrying the child of their captor. Here they get medical assistance and psychosocial support, key for these women and girls trying to reintegrate into their society.
Each one, they have a different story, how they survive. They need support. They need help.
Kinder Domli helps the women reach this center once they've escaped. He says more than 4,000 Yazidis remain in captivity. Around half of them are women.
At least 700 of them, they are in Mosul.
The center is now preparing to accommodate a new wave of victims, expected to arrive as Iraqi forces liberate areas under ISIS control. Among those still there is Nuhad's sister and several of her friends. She doesn't know what happened to them. We are all waiting for the day they liberate Mosul, she says, and all our girls will be free. But Domli is less optimistic. Most Yazidi women have been sold or given to ISIS commanders or senior fighters. He says in other battles, these men have fled first, taking the women with them.
Before liberating Shaddadi, we know there are more than 150 women there. But when they liberated, we didn't find anyone. When they liberate Fallujah, the same. We know there are more than 100 women there, but just we get 2 women. So we worry that same things happened in Mosul.
There have already been reports that senior ISIS members have left Mosul. So while Iraqi forces may be able to free the city of ISIS, that may not mean that Nuhad's sister and the hundreds of other women held there are coming home anytime soon. For The World, Rebecca Collard, Dohuk, Iraq.
We've got someone on the ground right now in Iraq, so it's your chance to weigh in. What would you like our reporter to ask the people fleeing Mosul or the soldiers trying to retake it? Tell us on Twitter. We're at PRI The World. A harpoon gun, a giant octopus called a Dorabella, and a lonely sea captain. It's not a modern-day Moby Dick. They're actually involved in a different story, one called Sea Hero Quest. It's actually a game for your smartphone. Players pretend they're the captain, and they have to navigate around in a boat. This is more than just a game, though. The app's being used to gather important information about dementia. It was developed by researchers at University College London, and already it's been downloaded by more than 2 million people. Dr. Hugo Spears is one of the project's leaders. He says researchers needed a better tool to identify one of the early symptoms of dementia, becoming disoriented.
And so that's what we set out to do here, is to do two things. One, to create a tool, a mobile app in this case that anyone could download anywhere, but also validate it, create a kind of benchmark of how humans of different ages perform inside our task and how men and women differ. Does it matter where you live in the world? So that's the overall aim. That's what we're trying to do with this project.
So I downloaded the Sea Hero Quest app, and I've got it going right now. I actually made it up to the third level the last time I played. It's actually a lot of fun. So I've got this little boat, and I'm trying to get it up the stream through these, looks like glaciers, right?
That's right. That's right.
I'm presented this map of the kind of stream that I'll be going down, close the map, and then I've got to navigate this boat. And it's actually a lot of fun. Can I take a guess at what this is telling us?
Sure, go for it.
So you get a chance to look at this map, and so I guess if you run onto the iceberg, you may be showing signs that you can't recall the directions on the map. Maybe some dementia there?
That is part of the idea. You mentioned you got to the level 3, and it's from that sort of point onwards it becomes much more of a challenge to remember where it was on the map that you need to go to. And just like you said, someone who has problems with finding the way around, what we're assuming is they won't be able to get to those checkpoints as efficiently as someone who's healthy.
What are the findings so far?
What we're getting is this pattern across the lifespan of how does their sense of direction change? And actually what I predicted before we set out was that people were going to be pretty stable, quite good across the lifespan, and maybe into older age it would start to decline. What we actually see in our data, and we got it back, was that really from the early 20s right through to the mid to late 70s, there's just a decline in performance across the whole lifespan. So there's not some critical age you should start worrying about. It's just natural that people get a bit less good at this.
Mm. But I gather there were some surprisingly different results from different parts of the globe. I'm just wondering if any of the data suggests like there are clusters in certain parts of the world of dementia.
That's a great question. So probably not telling us directly, you know, about the distribution of dementia. But how do people in different countries really compare on any type of cognitive ability? And I was really excited when I first looked at the results. I was kind of blown away because I thought it might be random, like just, you know, a mix of different countries, but it really wasn't. So at the top of our leaderboard of countries, we could see the Nordic countries, Finland, Sweden, Denmark, and Norway, all doing very well in that top set. Mm. And intermingled with them was New Zealand and Australia. Americans did quite well as well in the game. They're right at the top of the leaderboard.
What does all this tell us?
The first thing is that maybe there's some pattern. There's a pattern there to it. But what it will really tell us will come when we start to analyze further the data. You know, is it the healthcare provision? Is it the amount of outdoor activities they engage in? What might it be that causes this? So this is really the first cut through the data.
Hugo Speer is there. He's the leader of the Spatial Cognition Group at University College London. He helped develop the Sea Hero Quest smartphone app. News headlines are next. You're with The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. In the United Arab Emirates, a lot of kids speak more English than Arabic. This Emirati remembers her parents begging her to speak Arabic.
It was like maybe other kids feeling like when their parents say, like, you should eat your vegetables. It was like, great, cool, but no thanks.
Why English is so popular in the UAE, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. So you land in the United Arab Emirates. You'd expect to hear Arabic, right? But in Dubai or Abu Dhabi, the language on the streets and in cafes and malls is English. In fact, many Emiratis struggle in their own mother tongue, or so says one Emirati mom.
Unfortunately, the Arabic that is still taught is so boring, and it's so impractical. Like, they wouldn't know how to go to a shop and buy anything or ask for directions or anything like that, but then they could read a poem and quote you something that is completely impractical.
She is only one of the people the world's Shirin Jafari met on a recent reporting trip to the UAE. Shirin went to find out why Arabic seems to be playing second fiddle to English.
Ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome to Dubai International Airport.
In the time I spent in the UAE, even on the plane, Not once did I find I needed Arabic. At the airport, the Emirati immigration officer joked about my visa in English. Taxi drivers, hotel staff, waiters, all of them spoke English. In fact, I think it would have been much harder to get by without English.
Here's an excerpt from the story Shirin did for our World in Words podcast.
Let's meet Tala Badri and her family.
Hello!
Hi!
Beautiful house!
Thank you.
Badri is a single mother of two. Yeah. Yeah. Ali, her son, is 11, and Sara, her daughter, is 15.
Black coffee?
Yeah.
This is a typical Emirati family. Badri was born here. She married an Emirati, now her ex-husband. Her children were born and raised in this country. There's only one problem. The kids struggle with Arabic. English is their first language.
I feel sad that their Arabic isn't as good as it should be, most particularly for Ali, only because he's a boy and he is Emirati, and I think it's I think he will get picked on.
Some friends have already been talking, why don't you speak Arabic as your first language? You're an Emirati. You should speak Arabic your first language. Yeah.
What did you tell them?
Just nothing.
They laugh it off, but Badri worries. She worries, for example, about the compulsory military training that Ali will have to complete as soon as he's done with school, when he's 18 years old. His Arabic is so minimal, she says, he'll have difficulty socializing with his peers. And here's the thing. Ali is not alone. A lot of Emiratis, especially younger ones, are not fluent in Arabic.
Hello, hi, how are you?
As I was reporting this story, my guide, Razan Al-Zayani, said to me, wait, this is my story. This is exactly what happened to me and my friends. Great, I said, I want to meet them.
Hi, I'm so
nice to meet you.
So we stopped by her friend's apartment, which is located in a nice, quiet neighborhood in Dubai. Dina Sharad is a proud owner of a very cute and friendly Chihuahua.
Oh, he's not being shy at all. I was just going to say, he's kind of shy sometimes.
Her apartment is comfy with the air conditioning humming away in the background. Remember, this is the UAE, so it's pretty hot outside. So there's me, Razan, Dina Sharad, and a second Dina, Dina Gandur. So two Dinas.
I'm Dina Sharad, and I was born and raised in Abu Dhabi, and I've been in Dubai for 6 years.
We'll call Dina Sharad Dina number one.
I'm Dina Gandur. I was born in Abu Dhabi, and I've been in Dubai for about 6 years.
And Dina Gandur, Dina number two.
I'm Razan Al-Zayani. I grew up in the UAE, and I've been in Dubai for 6 years.
So what language did you grow up with? Maybe we can start here.
I definitely grew up with English.
That's Dina number two.
It was the language that was taught in school all the way from kindergarten. English was also spoken at home.
What did it make you feel when your parents insisted that you speak Arabic?
It was like maybe other kids feeling like when their parents say, like, you should eat your vegetables. It was like, great, cool, but no thanks.
For Razan, my guide, things started off well. Arabic was her strong subject, and she did like it.
And then I went to another school, which is the school that I met Dina and Dina. And Arabic didn't really have that much of an emphasis, and that's where I got my first detention ever.
In Arabic.
In Arabic class. And I remember her, and it was like my second week at the school, and I was like the new kid or whatever. I'm not going to say her name, but she's probably still alive, or maybe not. She gave me detention because I didn't know the meaning of a word. She made me stand up and say, like, what is the meaning of this? I don't even remember the word. And I didn't know. And then that became a switch. Like, it became a negative association with the language because it was taught in such an old school fashion. Like, the teachers were older, the books were just not interesting. There was nothing that we could relate to. Even us as Arabs, we all have different dialects, you know. So Dina's dialect would be a little bit different than the other Dina would be different than my dialect. So it's very easy to revert to English anyway. It just simplifies it. And I hated it. I hated Arabic classes. I hated Islamic classes.
So slowly, Arabic faded out of Razan and her friends' lives. Later on, they went to study in the US. No problem there. They spoke perfect English. But it was when they returned to the UAE to work that it hit them. They're Arabs, but they're not fluent in Arabic. Here's Dina number one, Dina Sharat.
When I started working like in a professional environment, my first like professional job, an advertising agency, and one of the clients I had was a Lebanese lady who preferred to speak in Arabic. So, of course, I was trying to make an impression. So I started speaking to her in Arabic in our first meeting. And then within 2 minutes, she actually looked at me and she's like, Dina, I have to stop you. I feel like you're more comfortable speaking in English. Like, will you just please switch? Like, it's fine. And that was, I was like, I am a professional woman. You know, I make like a decent salary and I'm here like in this professional work environment. And I felt shrunken.
They all had similar stories. So how did we get here? How did the UAE end up with a generation that finds it so hard to speak its mother language? For that, we have to go back to the time when the United Arab Emirates struck gold. Oil was discovered here in the late 1950s. With oil came money, and with money came development. Suddenly, this mainly desert country needed roads, hospitals, and airports. Construction boomed at dizzying pace. And it didn't take long for the word to get out. One man who was behind the development boom was Sheikh Zayed, the ruler of Abu Dhabi.
The vultures of world commerce descend on Zayed's little kingdom. They're perfectly decent vultures, just bankers and businessmen doing their job. $100 million a year is a nice piece of export market to get your hands on.
This is from a documentary about the UAE from the 1960s called Farewell Arabia. Sheikh Zayed wanted to modernize his city. No cost spared, not a second wasted.
And he's out every day to spur on the men who are making him a brand new kingdom.
Concrete, and this will be going out approximately a mile, and the second stage would be done next spring or next summer, whenever your highness decides.
English, this language you just heard, slowly started to make its mark on the Emirati life. Before the construction boom, the Emiratis were mainly pearl divers and raised camels. So they needed outside help to make this new kingdom become a reality. From the West came the British and Americans, who mainly developed the projects, and from the East came the workers.
Many of these expatriates are in the construction industry, service industries.
That's Alan Weber. He teaches English in Qatar.
And they're coming from countries like Pakistan, Nepal, Philippines, and Bangladesh.
Many countries where the British had considerable influence. And so how do all these people from so many different backgrounds communicate with each other? In English. At the same time, leaders in the UAE began to see English as the language of the future, of opportunity and growth. English entered classrooms. Emirati children had to learn to speak, read, and write in a language that was foreign to them until then.
Yes, that's the window. That's the window. That's the
ceiling. This is the floor. As English thrived both in schools and in Emirati society, Arabic slipped. You have to remember, all this happened in a very short time, in a span of about 4 decades. It's almost as if there was no time to consider what would happen if Arabic slowly faded. Recently, though, the tide has turned, somewhat. As one Emirati official told me, we need to get that language back. In 2008, the government felt it needed to make clear that Arabic is the UAE's official language. Then came conferences after conferences about the importance of Arabic language. Meetings, reports, and brainstorming ensued. By 2021, the ruler of Dubai has said, kids should be able to read and write comfortably in Arabic. One sign that things are slowly changing is this language institute in Dubai.
Saif, salam alaikum ya Saif.
Alaikum.
Saif is 3 years old. This is his first time in an Arabic class. Just a couple of minutes ago, his mom dropped him off. And he walked in reluctantly, tears streaming down his face. Now though, he's happily practicing his numbers in Arabic. Yusra Al-Hashemi came up with the idea for this place. She's kind and gentle. We sit down to chat over tea.
I would say 80-85% of our students are Arab. Both their parents are Arab. You will find their kids are not speaking Arabic. So I thought maybe let me open a center which will change the way of teaching the language. It will make it more up to date, more approachable for the kids, more interesting for them to learn it.
And so she ditched her corporate 9-to-5 job to start this institute.
It's not right to blame these kids when they grow up why they didn't learn the language, because there wasn't any alternatives for them. I have some kids, they tell their mother, why can you teach me your language?
The kids are saying, teach me your language.
Yes.
Not our language.
Yeah. Because they feel their parents are speaking a different language than the English that they speak it at home. So they feel, okay, teach me your language, you know?
What about you yourself? Do you have children?
I have kids, and I see it with my children. Because they're like, when they go to school, they speak English the whole day. So when they come back home, with each other, they speak English. So I have to remind them, you have to speak Arabic, you have to speak Arabic. With me, they speak Arabic.
How do they feel about that when you tell them you have to speak?
I know, sometimes they get annoyed. But I feel as I said, like, it's very challenging. But if you let go, then it's very difficult to ask them later to speak it.
كيف الحال يا شيخة? The kids practice the names of fruits, hi, how are you, things like that, and they seem pretty into it. But of course, Al-Hashimi is not naive. She knows that change can't happen overnight. And a couple of hours of classes like these won't magically turn kids into fluent Arabic speakers.
We have some mothers which they come to us and they said, please make sure that my child learn the language and how you will teach him and all that. And when she want to leave him in the class and she goes, she doesn't speak with him in Arabic. She said, okay, bye, Muhammad, I'll see you later. You know, I feel, oh my God, yani, you want 1 hour this child to understand and learn everything in this 1 hour? So, and then I think everything starts from the home.
Back with Razan, Dina 1 and Dina number 2, I wanted to know whether they would do things differently, if and when they have their own kids. Would they emphasize Arabic first? Would that even be possible, since their own first language is not Arabic?
It's really Arabic. Funny, because I was like, Dina, your first answer should be, of course.
That's Dina number 2.
But I'm also thinking of the global world that we live in, and the fact that we do expect somebody to speak English somewhere, everywhere that we go. I think it's a beautiful language. I'm like Dina, and Razan, I'm super proud to be Arab, and I think there is something really significant about protecting it and having it live on. But being the overachiever that I am, I'd probably want my kid to speak like 7 languages.
Razan and Dina number 1 said they would definitely want their kids to learn Arabic and English. It's going to be a challenge, they admit, but it's important to them. Language is such a big part of your identity. Could you be a full-on Emirati if you don't speak Arabic? Would Ali be an Emirati if he doesn't understand the speech the UAE's leader gives in Arabic? I put this to Ali's mom, Tala Badri.
I think identity is a very personal thing and it's very internal. It might be different from people who look from the outside in, but that's somebody else's perception. So if somebody sees Ali, they wouldn't know that he was Emirati unless he was wearing a kandura.
That's the formal Emirati dress.
But I don't think that detracts from identity, because we know who we are and where we come from.
Badri tells me Ali has prepared a speech in Arabic, and he hopes to one day recite it to the ruler of Dubai, in person. Ali wants to get better at Arabic, but he says at least for now, he's more comfortable speaking English. And maybe he is the face of this new Emirati identity, an English-speaking Arab.
The World's Shirin Jafari there, reporting for our language podcast, The World in Words. Subscribe to The World in Words on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's meeting between President-elect Donald Trump and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has us thinking about Okinawa. The island is central to the U.S.-Japan relationship. More than 50,000 U.S. troops and their families are stationed on Okinawa. It's all part of a deal that goes back to the end of World War II. that kept Japan from having its own active military. Today, Japan relies on the U.S. military as a buffer against countries like North Korea and China. Trump has repeatedly said that Japan should pay more for hosting U.S. forces. Reporter Sonia Narang is on Okinawa, and she says all eyes are on Trump.
The Japanese are very interested in this meeting. People are talking about how this meeting could possibly impact military bases. 75% of all military bases in Japan are on this tiny island. So I asked a lot of people what they think if Donald Trump does decide to move forward and withdraw troops. And many of them were worried that it could actually affect stability in Okinawa, you know, given rising tensions with North Korea. They are worried that they could lose a lot of their safety and security, and they hope that Donald Trump will soften his stance.
So with Trump potentially asking Japan to pay more for the U.S. military forces there, what do Okinawans think about that?
Every single Okinawan person I talked to said that that is not fair. They really don't think that Japan should be asked to pay more, given that they are already paying quite a fair sum. And I spoke to a pineapple shop owner in the market just the other day, and here's what he says. He says, I saw on the Sunday TV program that the Japanese government is paying 70% of the cost of the U.S. military in Japan, but Mr. Trump doesn't know about it. From now on, Mr. Trump is going to learn, and when he has a deeper understanding, then he's not going to say such radical things.
What is the cost right now of this base?
Japan is already paying about $1.8 billion annually to the U.S. government. That is already a pretty big figure. And in fact, the percentage of what Japan is paying the U.S. for the U.S. military is much greater than Germany and South Korea.
The U.S. base in Okinawa has always been kind of controversial. It's almost surprising to hear Okinawans kind of support it and say, don't leave. What about the people in Okinawa who remember, you know, the cases of rapes of Japanese women by troops stationed at the base? What are you hearing from the anti-U.S. base folks there in Okinawa who actually want the U.S. military out?
Right. So a lot of the folks that have long been protesting against the bases are saying that they don't even think that Donald Trump can really change anything. But I did talk to a woman who owns a flower shop just down the street from Futenma Air Station, which is actually one of the most controversial bases because of the extreme noise and safety concerns from aircrafts. And she actually told me that she has a little bit of hope that Donald Trump might be able to close down the base. She said she cannot believe that such an outrageous person was even elected. But even though it sounds strange, she has some sort of hope or expectation that Donald Trump might be able to close down this base, which is something that no other president before him could even do.
You also spoke with a spokesperson from the U.S. military, Sonia. What did they tell you?
He was telling me it's not just Japan that's benefiting from the military presence here. It's actually the entire Asia-Pacific region, because it's actually to really make sure that things remain peaceful here.
Reporter Sonia Narang up late in Okinawa, Japan. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
And finally today, throughout his life, Nigerian musician Fela Kuti had a message and a mission: give voice to the oppressed and hold corrupt governments accountable for their oppression. It's something that Fela's son, Seyun Kuti, shares with his late father. And right now, Seyun's got some things to say about the U.S. election.
Well, you know, I think the liberals are to blame for Donald Trump, really.
Okay, that's a punchline to a question I asked Seyun Kuti about his new EP called Struggle Sounds. I had asked him what struggle he was talking about.
The class struggle in the world means that the elite always tries to put a lot of division in the working class and poor people of the world. It's the same kind of oppression and economic destabilization that is felt by the worker in Texas, in Flint, Michigan, that is felt by the workers in Lagos, in Johannesburg, everywhere. It's the same, you know, because the elites, they've created a system whereby they can move their capital as they like, but labor cannot move. Labor is not as fluid as the capital. So workers continue to live precarious lives, while the rich can take their money and look for poor labor elsewhere. Labor cannot take itself to look for a better life elsewhere.
I told Sheyankuti that's one of the explanations given for why people here voted for Donald Trump. They saw him as solving those problems. Then I asked him a more direct question about the election. What does President-elect Trump say about America today?
Everybody's suddenly screaming that America is racist. You know, America voted for Obama twice. Not to say there's no racism in America. You know, I'm a black man, so I know for sure that America is racism. And Trump is America. So for anybody to try and just act as if Trump is an anomaly, to me, is a slap in the face to we in the third world that experience American foreign policy every day. Struggle music, struggle sound, struggle people, struggle now.
Struggle music, struggle sound, struggle people, struggle now. Sheyankuti knows these are trying times. He feels the polarization on tour here in the U.S., at home in Nigeria, everywhere he goes. But the birth of his daughter, who is now three, gives Sheyun reason to hope and to get to work.
Since I had my daughter, I've had to intensify my consciousness. I've had to intensify my studying. I've had to intensify my understanding because I feel like I made a selfish decision to bring her into this world. I never consulted her. I and her mother, we made her, you know, and we brought her into this world. This world that is so upside down, so topsy-turvy. I have to double my effort to make sure that it's a better place for her to grow up in. Telling you get down is an extra revolution. I cannot find the darkness, you know, when she's around me. My daughter is my light. She's really like a jolt of hope in my heart when I see her. She's my greatest therapy.
The voice of Nigerian musician Sheyankuti there. You're hearing the title track from his new EP, Struggle Sounds, and that's where we leave you today. We'll be back tomorrow. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for making it here today.
Struggle sound, struggle people, struggle now. Struggle music, struggle sound, struggle people, struggle now. Struggle now for some justice. I am people, I am nation. Struggle now to heal the pain in the human family. I am people, I am nation. I say, struggle now for some justice. I am people, I am nation. Struggle now to heal the pain in the human family. I am people, I am nation. Struggle now to exist, struggle now for survival. I am people, I am nation. Struggle now to refix it, the struggle never final. I am people, I am nation. Let the iron people build iron nation. I am people, I am nation. Let iron nation go fight oppression. Struggle life no easy. Only iron for sharp and iron. Struggle life no easy.
PRI, Public Radio International.